aka Dr. Thomas Stanley. This concert on Friday, September 27th, is presented by Capital Bop. Tickets and more info can be found at capitalbop.com. That's CAPITALBOP.com.
Hi, this is Miyuki Williams.
And I'm Robin Holden. This is Reggae Music and the Reggae Experience present a WPFW fundraising concert featuring Image Band, Curlew Reggae All-Stars Band, Lady Flame, and Carl Malcolm.
On Saturday, October 5th, 7 p.m. until midnight at King Solomon Lodge, 2245 Rhode Island Avenue, Northeast.
Tickets available at Eventbrite by searching WPFW.
All proceeds to benefit WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Peace, this is Atan Thomas, and you're listening to WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
On the margin with EFA Burt Miller. My guest today is James Early. James Early is a former Assistant Secretary for Education and Public Service at the Smithsonian Folklife Center. While at the Smithsonian, he was also the Director of Cultural Heritage Policy Center for Folklore, Life, and Culture. 202-588-9. James, on July 16, 2024, the scholar, singer, composer, and activist Dr. Bernice Johnson Regan died. She was a founding member of the SNCC Freedom Singers, a founder of the singing group Sweet Honey in the Rock. Dr. Regan created the program in Black American Culture at the Smithsonian Institution. During her lifetime, she received the MacArthur Foundation Genius Award, as well as the President Medal for the contribution to public understanding of the humanities. James, what I want to do, begin our program, is by reading an excerpt from James Forman, The Making of Black Revolutionaries. And I think this is still one of the best books written about the civil rights movement. Forman served as executive secretary of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee from 1961 to 1966. And this is what he writes about Bernice. Your understanding of the historical process of liberation keeps you singing. You have been able to forge new words to meet changing conditions. You have grown with the demands of the struggle. Your life is forever unfolding as the lives of your people unfold and move down the path of liberation. Your songs today of Africa fit the transition in which we find ourselves. From the dusty roads of Albany, Georgia, through the cities of the United States, from many years ago and for many years to come, the music you make is only a reflection of your total understanding. Through the years, your love for humanity and hatred of oppression will keep you singing. Comment on that, James Early.
Well, one, I think you're correct that this is one of the most important books on the civil rights movement, and I think it's one of the most important documentations, firsthand documentations about the role and presence and singularity in terms of contributions of Bernice Johnson Regan. He, just to quote him again, and when the call came to protest the killings, you were up front. You led the line. Your feet hit the dirt pavement with a sureness of direction. You walked proudly on with singing, "This Little Light of Mine," and the people echoed, "Shine, shine, shine." It illustrates how grounded Bernice was in community. Forman also notes that prior to the Albany movement, the freedom songs had not been a consistent part of, quote unquote, the resistance struggle, but it was, as he says, the unforgettable voice of Bernice Johnson Regan leading the way herself, led by the awakened spirit of an awakened people. So I think we need to look at Bernice as a social construct that had a high individual profile. And I think Forman captures that. And I would refer people to look at that book because it also indicates that Bernice was always grounded in a consciousness and a documentation about the community in which she grew up, the community in which she was embedded. And so her scholarship, if you will, her research and documentation really predates her formal education, both at Albany State at 16, where she ended Albany State, and her PhD work at Howard University starting in 1971.
Let me ask you a large question. How important are songs and music when we discuss social movements?
Fundamentally important because, and Bernice is an exemplar of that, as are many others, but songs reflect the sensibility, the ways of knowing and doing, the emotional character of grassroots communities when we talk about folk songs or community-based culture. They are historical reflections of the ways of knowing and doing that's characteristic of a community. And in that context, then we have highly individualized expressions, as we saw in the case of Bernice.
You know, one of the things I was reading that Bernice Regan was responsible for doing, at least she talks about doing it, and that is singing and changing the ear in a space.
Yes. You know, Bernice had a saying that Dr. Amy Horowitz likes to recite, that if something is missing, it's probably the sound of your own voice. And so agency, self-agency, self-reflection in relationship to others was something.
Jazz musician Herbie Hancock and his band, featuring Terrence Blanchard, graced the stage of the Warner Theater on Friday, September 27th. Info available at warnertheater.com.
How has that book changed your life? What has been the response from people who were adopted, as well as parents who adopted a child?
So you're talking about American Bastard, and this is the cover. Here's the cover here with me at age six with a shotgun shooting people, you know.
No, that's why I'm protecting myself.
Imaginary people. Yeah, it's been a really big change for me. And, you know, not surprisingly, but I've done a lot of readings around the country, and people have been, I was nervous at the beginning when I was reading. I was scared is a better word. I was scared to read it and worried about how people would respond. But I've gotten some really wonderful responses. Besides Q&As after the readings, people would come up to me and talk about their experiences, and there's been a lot of tears and people's stories, and adoptive parents have come up to me, and mothers who have given up their children, and adoptees, all parts of the adoption triad have approached me, and it's been really moving for me. And people have been very, you know, caring and really interested, and they want to know more, not just about my story, but more about how they can proceed in their search, or how they can handle A, B, and C, you know, how, and there's some really sad stories that I've, you know, that inevitably come up, as in, for example, people searching for their birth parents and sort of waiting too long, finding out that they have already died, or, you know, that they're ill, etc. So there's been a lot. There's been a lot, and it's changed me. I mean, it's been really freeing for me to finally talk about the story of how things happen. And I think it's changed my poetry also. I feel a lot more open in how I'm talking about things. And I feel like a big weight has been lifted off of me. It's not like everything has been solved or anything like that, but it's something that I feel like I needed to do for many years, and it was a long way to get there. It took me about 20 years to write that book. And
you know, I was curious as to how many poems in Drag Strip, in your new collection, were written before you published American Bastard.
None.
So that's almost like saying that the writing of American Bastard opened a door for a lot of poems to come out.
Yeah, I mean, Drag Stripping came more quickly than some of my other books, and came differently. And I was kind of surprised that I do have some poems about the orphanage. I was born in an orphanage in Pittsburgh in the Hill District, and I have some orphanage poems in drag stripping, which I never felt okay to write about before, for some reason. And
well, hold on to that point, you have been in a position where you've taught people, you know, trying to get them to write. And so here you're just explaining, like, I have difficulty sometimes writing. So how do you help somebody, you know, in terms of finding their voice and writing about things they might find difficult?
Well, you know how that goes. I mean, it's one thing to try to facilitate other people in letting go and doing exercises and et cetera to go deep into what they're holding back. It's a whole nother thing to do it for yourself. And there's a lot of, with a lot of things that are withholding, I mean, there's a lot of shame and fear and anger around the orphanage stuff for me, and not also there's a lot of not knowing, and now I don't know what happened there, and so how do I write about it, you know? It's a, and there's also a cultural problem with it, I think, because you're not supposed to write about the orphanage, you're supposed to write about the happy day you were adopted.
But you know, I look at my, what I did when I wrote my first memoir, Father in Words, when I went back and looked at it, I saw that throughout the entire manuscript, there were questions, because I was the baby of the family, with a lot of things I didn't know about my family before I was born into it, you know. And so I liked the approach. I said, well, throughout this book, there's questions. And when you ask someone to examine their life, like you're teaching a memoir workshop, there's a lot of things you don't know about your life. I mean, that's why you're in the workshop, perhaps. But you don't have to, I feel, answer those questions. I think that raising the question is very important for just healing oneself.
Right, right. And I would push on that a little bit, because, I mean, I didn't know where I came from. I didn't know my name, you know, until I was in my 30s. I mean, that's kind of a big question, you know. Not that other questions, it's not useful to compare people's losses or people's sorrows. I'm very clear on that. And yet, you know, maybe that's what I'm doing. I mean, not knowing who I am, not knowing my name, is kind of big. You know, and I did find that out, and met my birth mother and birth father. But that walking around, not knowing how I got here, was a big thing for me.
Well, let's have you read one of the poems, "The Body's River."
Okay. Okay. Okay, and this one starts with the orphanage, the body's river. I was born for betrayal. When my mother left me in the orphanage, I invented love with strangers. And if it wasn't there, I made it be there. Until the crash, the revelation. They say blues is three chords and the truth. And poetry is long line lies and a deep dive into the body's costly river.
Listening to Jan Beatty reading from her new book, Drag Stripping. You know, I it's only 8 lines in this poem, but I stopped and I said, what does Jan mean in this opening line? You know, I was born for betrayal. And then the other question I had is, what does it mean to invent love?
Yeah. You know, I don't know that I can explain everything. I can definitely explain I invented love with strangers. I mean, if you're in an orphanage, you sort of have to invent things, because you don't know who's who. You don't know, you're with strangers. And so if you want to be loved, you have to make it up. You have to invent it. You know, what is it? So you invent it with strangers, and which is really sad. And It does, you know, you may be in a family, so-called natural family, where you're loved, or you may be in a natural family where you're not loved, and you might have to invent it there too. But this is like you sort of have to invent it in an old age. I was born for betrayal. You know, I guess I was thinking of the speaker of the poem, but I definitely name being left in an orphanage. So I think that's about being dropped off, mm-hmm. you know?
Well, you know, in this film, there's a reference to the blues throughout your book. And I was wondering, when did you seek comfort in this music? And I know in another poem you write, I'm growling into blues shouts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always, growing up, you know, I was a kid in the 60s, and I don't know if you're old enough to remember, but, you know, I would...
Wait a minute, I think I'm older than you.
I don't know, but let's not get into it. But I was running around with a transistor radio listening to Wham-O in Pittsburgh, and I didn't realize at the time that Wham-O stands for, you know, Allegheny, Monongahela, Ohio. I didn't know that till recently, but anyway, I was listening to Wham-O, which was one of the only stations around Pittsburgh that played what they called then, you know, black music, but they were playing blues, they were playing cool music. So I was running around as a kid listening to all this stuff, and, you know, I didn't know what it was, but I just liked it, you know. And so it's been a long time I've been listening to blues and R&B and just loving it. And I think music saved me just as much as poetry, I think, because I needed something that made sense to me, and music was it. Although I was always writing also, but I needed something other than the family that I was in, you know, a place to go, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you describe, and we'll get into this further in terms of music, but I was looking at the whole thing about, you know, blues shouts. Many times blues shouters are actually men. But, and I went back and I thought about you, and I said, you know, when I met Jan, she seemed to be such a quiet person. And I said, I was wondering if you were describing an inner shout or simply the need to shout.
Well, you're talking about me, or are you talking about the poem?
I'm talking about you. we can deal with the poems later.
Just poetry. Well, yeah, I have a quiet voice, but if you hung out with me, I don't think you'd say I'm quiet.
No, you're not. You're very opinionated.
Blue Shouters, you know, is about, I almost called the book Blue Shouters, because it's about finding that voice from deep inside and letting it out, finding it. I mean, I know, you know, so many women who have trouble finding that voice because of, you know, cultural oppression, and then finding it is an amazing, amazing thing. And then letting it out, forget about it, try to stop it after that. And it's funny, strange. I've arrived at certain cities to read, and people have said to me more than once, they've said, oh, we thought you'd be tougher. I said, look, this is all you get. This is all I have. And I don't know what they were thinking.
When I first met you, and I would say, even from afar, I said, and this is it's like these writers' conference, I said, she must have a motorcycle parked around the corner. Because you have, I mean, and it links to this book. I mean, when I looked at this book, I said, I wonder if this is Jan's jacket, you know, because what happens is that there is a look that you have. And this is why I go back to the thing. It's a quiet, tough look, but it's a quiet look. Carlos Hernandez, who did the cover.
Oh, I love him.
Talk about him. And then I'm going to go back to this jacket and ask you whether in this jacket, the jacket is a mask or a metaphor for a mask.
Okay. Carlos Hernandez is this amazing artist who lives in Houston, Texas. And I found his work online. I was just looking for something for the cover, and I just loved his work. And but I wanted to meet him because I wanted someone I liked on the cover. And so I went to Houston, and we hung out, and he's the greatest guy you ever want to meet. And he's so cool. So I would recommend anyone to buy his work. And he has, you know, a lot of very hip work. He has all kinds of paintings and prints, and but very you know, work like this cover. He has a lot of rock and roll work. He was the artist a couple years ago for South by Southwest in Austin. He has work shown in the Smithsonian. So he has a range of work. So I'll check him out.
Did you want the jacket on the cover? Did you give him the idea of what you wanted, and then he just met you like halfway?
Well, let me revise that. This is not actually my jacket. This is, you know, originally a jacket that Carlos Hernandez had had drawn for a tribute to Warren Zevon when he died. But it was a very different image, where it said, instead of drag stripping, it said, "I'll sleep when I'm dead," you know, from Warren Zevon titles. And so I have a jacket like this. And so I guess I decided it was my jacket, but it's actually not my jacket. But I have a jacket like this. But so I asked Carlos, like, can we, because it wasn't made, you know, it wasn't commissioned by Warren Zevon, but it was made in honor of it. I said, is there any way we could use this jacket and I could put my titles on it and blah, blah. He said, well, let's try it. And he was very, very, you know, cooperative in doing this and very cool in doing this. So I came up with the titles that I wanted, and he did it, and it was great. So that's how it came about. And I saw this image in his studio in Houston. So that's sort of the longer story.
Okay. Yeah. So let's look at, I want you to talk about how you are using the word drag strip and drag stripping. And okay. I want you to read the poems on drag and drag stripping.
Okay. You want me to start with the poems first?
You can go either way. It's your show.
It's my show now. Okay.
It's your show. You have a radio. This is your show. Good. No profanity now.
Okay. I'll skip the profanity and drag stripping. Okay. Okay. This is drag with a line from Neil Young. They say I have attachment disorder from years in the orphanage. I say I'm attached to dirt, to the grit of stones, pulverized metal from the slag heap. I learned touch from air. I fashion love from strangers. Your families make no sense to me. My mother's the forebarrel of a 409. My heart's drag stripped from the shredded tires of predators. Go ahead. Think of me, throw the red flag down. I'm one you'd never figured. Dead engines start on a quarter mile strip. My low jack is the split, the pull away. You back there, me running the distance. And drag stripping is a poem that it took me many, many years to write. I didn't know how to do it. I like 20 years to write. And I needed to grow as a writer. I needed to grow as a person. Drag stripping. I met a stripper on my first visit to the Big West. Sitting on a hill in Marin, I was wearing a black, red, yellow plaid shirt. She wore something more open, loose, sleeveless, her knees to her chest. She was pulling at the brown California grass. throwing it back down. I loved looking at her plain brown hair falling over the side of her face. I was still wearing women's clothes and shoes, but I made myself a believer that day. Her thick belt, heavy boots, brown eyes. The way she looked at me until I had to look away. She was boy, and I hadn't met anyone like her yet. Look at her blue shirt. She opened me. The way she tore at the grass hard, then threw it. We walked the hills in Marin. I wanted to be like her. I wanted to be her. I couldn't even say what she had, but I wanted it. Our time lasted only weeks, but her face still comes to me. I made myself a queen that day. Inside, I felt the turning diamonds of a life not lived, someone else's life, now mine, holding the vision heavy as mud. I thought, just a push into my own bleeding heart. I could feel the brass screws of the rail's underside, a train running without me. I could feel the spikes and the crosscuts, and I came alive in the fading light and the sky full of birds, and I did, and it was fierce and wild and back to the wall scary. It was off on whenever she was there. I was a blank slate with a hard body. It was everything I wanted, someone to kiss me nice and slow, then slam me onto the ground's body. It would be years until I knew her, knew that part of me as I searched secondhand stores for men's clothing, men's size 7 shoes, looking for the boy man in me. I don't believe in salvation, but look at her body stripping, jerking to one side, head bent. Hair covers her face, breasts large and moving, her thickness wet with boy sweat between her legs. A strip shot across a pitch black stage, flash of a woman running her show. However she wants you, she can have you. Half of a whole body stripping for you, the body divided against itself in beauty. I made myself a man watching her. The strip shot breaks apart into millions of shot back stars, cutting the night apart into a cross-cut body, heart and lovely. Some people say half isn't anything, but it will drive an ocean back to the center. She'll take your money and you'll thank her in the cage of your body, drowning in the stripping, loving the shot back body, their ghost of everything you wanted. Jerking you into pleasure, jerking you into your own story with a strip shot of ammo to the vulva, triangle of light, triangle of her, three sides of lust, the fourth eye. I saw the future in her body, but I didn't know my questions. All that came out of my mouth were birds.
You're listening to Jan Beattie reading from her book, Drag Stripping. Jan, you know, many times when we're looking at drag involving cross-dressing and transforming one's sex through the use of makeup or costume, I was wondering in terms of how do you navigate that in a poem?
Well, I mean, I think that's partially what the title poem is about, you know. And it's not clear purposefully, and it's not clear in reality in the poem. A woman slash man dressing, undressing, we see her, his body moving, stripping. And so it is a form of drag, I would say. Maybe not the traditional drag you might think of, as in, you know, perhaps a man dressing up as a woman, or vice versa, but it, a form of drag. And so there's that. And then, so that meaning of drag in the book, and then I think there's other meanings of drag in the book, as in, you know, what drags us down in our lives. That's definitely in there. Different forms of stripping, as in the actual strip club, drag in a strip club, and stripping away what we don't need in our life, or stripping away of friends, of sorrow, of mothers, you know, in our lives. So I feel like there's a lot of different meanings of the word, and that was one reason I used it for the title of the book. Mm-hmm. And I realized that drag stripping might not be totally easily apprehended as in the book, and that's kind of the point of it, I think.
You know, when you talked about how long it took you to write this poem, this would be, if I'm not mistaken, one of your longer poems. And so I was wondering in terms of how you were handling that form. Also, I was wondering in terms of, one, how you conceptualize a poem. Did the poem come to you over periods of years? And then also, I was wondering, when you talk about, like, say, 20 years, how did you handle revision? Were you constantly, being Walt Whitman and revising things every 2 years or something like that? I just wanted, to take us through this process. And I say this, Jan, because, when I posted on social media about this interview, you have a number of people who immediately say, oh, I love Jan Beattie's work. And so if it takes you 20 years to write a poem, I think it's very important for the people who love your work to get a sense of the process. It's not that, it's like, okay, Steph Curry's hitting threes. Yeah, but yeah, Jan Beattie's working through many, many years, in practice to get this poem out.
Yeah, this one, I didn't know if it ever would be finished. And so I was trying to write about, like a lot of my poems, part of it's true, part of it's not true, everybody knows that poetry is not autobiography, but there's a sense of truth in the poem. I was trying to write about, obviously, gender and the sliding nature of it, and desire, and I just didn't know how to do it, and I didn't want to do it badly, and that's what stopped me. Every time I was trying to do it, it just wasn't good. It wasn't good enough. And the last thing I wanted to do was write a bad poem about this. I didn't want to
Well, I think what you did is that you think about how long it takes you, but the fact that this poem is out now, I think, speaks to the times. I think that this is an issue that I think is very important as we deal with issues of sexuality, gender, transgender, so many things that I think in this poem, if it was in a class, we could have an interesting discussion.
Sure.
Somebody could read this poem and say, oh, okay, let me share something with the group that I would not share.
Well, sure, and great, but that's not why I'm doing it.
We know that. Okay, this is how literature works. We just set the table.
But I want to say what happened in the revision. Mm-hmm. So I was at this residency called Story Knife in Alaska, in Homer, Alaska, for women, and I would recommend women apply to this place. It's the best place in the world. So I was there, and I had the time, and I went back to some old journals. I took some journals with me, and so I have journals, from like 30, 40 years ago, and I've been doing this thing where I'm going back to this old stuff and grabbing it, and not knowing what the hell I was writing about before. Mm-hmm. And that's good. But this two or three stanzas from this poem came from a poem that was about a woman pushing her boyfriend down the stairs, that poem did not work. And it wasn't a friendly poem, okay? But those stanzas were violent. And somehow they worked in this poem. And I'm not going to read them, but they were the stanzas about that said, The brass screws of the rails underside, a train running without me, the spikes and the crosscut. Those stanzas. But then I was confused. I'm like, why are these stanzas seeming to work in a poem about desire when these stanzas are about violence? And I'm like, that was disturbing me. And I'm like, are there parts of desire that include violence? And I knew the answer could be yes to that, but I didn't want to go there, and I didn't want that in the poem. And you know, I was just fighting a lot.
Let's go back to something you said, okay? You said this little reference to how people saw you as this assassin. and I always thought from reading your work, there was a considerable degree of violence in your work. I mean, that's just a theme that's there.
Yeah. Well, I know. I'm not denying that, but I was trying to write this poem about this woman.
Well, I'm going to help you out. I'm going to help you out. We're going to take a break.
Okay.
And so my guest today is Jen Beatty. We're discussing her book, Drag Stripping. My name's Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Hi, this is Miyuki Williams.
And I'm Robin Holden. This is Reggae Music and the Reggae Experience present a WPFW fundraising concert featuring Image Band, Curlew Reggae All-Stars Band, Lady Flame, and Carl Malcolm.
On Saturday, October 5th, 7 p.m. until midnight at King Solomon Lodge, 2245 Rhode Island Avenue Northeast.
Tickets available at Eventbrite by searching WPFW.
All proceeds to benefit WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
People said all she needed was a job, and I guess they're right. And probably everyone thought she needed love, but everybody says you've got to earn that, though I think love's a gift, the way money is for some who have a lot and never earned it. I don't know. But a few nights later, when I walked past there, the insects were at their cheerful static. Aside from them, the woods were silent and there were fireflies.
Jen Beatty sharing with you a poem by the late Ed Orchester. That poem can be found in his book, Snow White Horses, Selected Poems 1973 to 1988. So thank you for that reading and our memory of Ed, who was the general editor of the University of Pittsburgh Press. Jen Beatty, your new book opens with a poem, Sanctified. And I wanted you to read that poem and have us begin to talk about Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got a guitar. You got a guitar behind you. You can just bring that down and.
Yeah, if I could only play it.
You could only play it.
It's an Epiphone Wildcat.
It looks good.
It does look good. So this is Sanctified for Sister Rosetta Tharpe. And she was one of the original blues shouters. She started in gospel and kind of slid over to blues. And as you started to say, the blues shouters were belted their songs with a fervor and energy. And there's this great YouTube that you can take a look at when she was on tour with Muddy Waters, 1964, Manchester, England, May 7th, and she was on this railroad platform, and it's in this dress, and she was running up and down the platform playing this guitar. It's really something, and supposedly that very concert had an impact on some British rockers like Clapton, Keith Richards, you know, Jeff Beck, and
she's also walking around in that big coat like Aretha Franklin.
She was great. Okay. Okay, Sanctified for Sister Rosetta Tharpe. Dear Sister Rosetta, it's 50 years too late, but I love your high-heeled guitar playing, the way they said you railed your white Les Paul custom like a Tommy gun, gospel wild and showing the men how it's done. Double cutaway fins, your dress breathing red flowers, hugging your full-size body, and I don't want to be redeemed, but I have become glorious in the halls of tricked out love from the glint of your enormous necklace. Hearing your soul heavy voice surge, flowers blur as your chest swells with song. I'm blown away by my own bullets of trouble. Sister, I'm saying what you always knew, that real is real, that in the nightclub wailing and the strap-on guitars, there's no happy ending, just the blues shatters, scorching, sanctified.
Thank you for that reading, Jan Beattie. I would say that if you want to know more about Rosetta Tharpe, Gail Wall, who's here in Washington, D.C. at George Washington University, is the author of Shout, Sister, Shout, the untold story of rock and roll trailblazer Sister Rosetta Tharpe. Rosetta Tharpe died in 1973. Here in Washington, part of D.C. history is Tharpe's wedding back in 1951, which was at Griffith Stadium. I think it was 20,000 people there for her wedding vows.
Wow.
But it's a lot there. But I want to, when we talk about Rosetta Tharpe, she has this song, Train to Glory. And I was going to ask you, Jen, mm-hmm. you little sinner, you see yourself on this train to glory. I just say that in terms of, you talk about how much the music is.
Yeah.
And we're talking about, you know, I mentioned earlier about the blues and the powder, but you're also dealing with Rosetta Tharpe, who's coming out of the gospel. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering in terms of how that's affecting you.
Gospel music or the gospel?
Both. I like that. Gospel music or the gospel. Both.
Well, I mean, I love gospel music. I mean, I love that feel of it and the energy of it. Absolutely. And I think that you feel that in blues music. You know, I was raised with a heavy Catholic thing. And I mean, because I was so terrified as a kid, I used to go to church every day. I would go to church every day instead by myself, instead of going to recess. You know, they should have sent me to a shrink early on, but they didn't. And because I was afraid of being killed, I was afraid that I would die, go to hell, and be burned forever. You know, I had an imagination. And I was being taught some crazy stuff. And the iconography of the Catholic Church was freaking me out, you know, like a dead guy on a cross, all this blood, you know. And the women were virgins and they couldn't explain this birth. And I remember I was in Catholic schools and I remember fighting with the nuns and I was saying, you know, there is no transubstantiation. Are you telling me this really turns into the body? I mean, they hated me, you know.
If this was a movie, you'd be fleeing from the church, you'd be grabbing your leather jacket, and you'd be getting on your motorcycle and dashing off into the distance.
Yeah, see you later.
But I want to get back to this music, because,
yeah,
you know, when we go back and listen to what you were saying about the blues, and I saw that, and you have that demeanor, you have that personality. But then I said, wow, this gospel scene like this would help you just overcome things. It would lift you up. And that's why I was thinking how you would balance this blues with this gospel.
What are you?
I'm trying to convert you.
Yeah. Doing something, I don't know. But I'll tell you, when I, Well, but, you know, no.
I know you're gonna push back.
I don't wanna be redeemed, I don't wanna be saved. No, I feel like blues and rock and roll have saved me, have converted mm-hmm. me into being alive and wanting to be alive, and that's the big thing, and I'm grateful for it. And absolutely.
Let's have you read the poem Spoonful.
Okay.
That's page 41.
Thank you.
So you see how you should be in church?
I should not be in church. Okay. I don't think there's any profanity in here. I don't think. Okay. Okay, but I've always loved that song, Spoonful. And I've always loved Howlin' Wolf, that growling thing. Okay. Did you ever see him in concert?
No, but I tell you one thing in my life that I've always go back and remember is being in a hotel room with Muddy Waters.
Really?
Yeah, I just love Muddy Waters' face. You know what I mean? It's just like his very beautiful face.
Oh, I never saw Muddy Waters either.
Yeah. All right, let's get to the Spoonful.
Okay, Spoonful after Howlin' Wolf. Dear Mr. Wolf, your grinding gravel voice wrecks me down to disappearing. And I know Willie Dixon wrote Spoonful, but you sell it with your whole body growl, massive hands on the filigreed 50s mic in the Memphis clubs where they made you use the back door, your body bigger than the frame. Mr. Wolf, tree of a man, how do you reach down inside? Pull up the howling and you're dangerous wearing a skinny tie. It could be a spoonful of diamond. It could be a spoonful of gold. You make me feel my body. I'm vibrating blue. I'm a ray of light, alive with the tenderness that travels with burning. I want to be inside someone. Please help me be lost to myself and emerge as another. Willie said it wasn't about dope, but when I heard Spoonful, I went back. The first time I did heroin with Jesus freaks in the bathroom stalls of the Stanley Theater, Mylon the Fever in his full-length fur and hot as fire, but clean and saved. Mylon of Alvin Lee and 10 years after, back to the Jesus concert in Pittsburgh where I sat in front and he sat next to me, told me stories of hanging with George Harrison and the Maharishi in India and how he was saved. Are you saved? He said. Not yet, I said. But all I could see was his perfect jaw, his blue eyes drilling me, then his slide outside to his 63 Lincoln with suicide doors. But Mr. Wolf, it's not rescue, it's deliverance I want. The high and your low down howl, 45 in your throat, flanked by Hubert Sumlin on Strat, Willie Dixon on upright bass. Everyone says there's nothing like heroin, and that's true. I wanted to float the disappearing dream, and I got it. Then 3 days dope sick and no gravel to hold on to, just the lack, the wish, the cold floor. The bent strings of your semi-hollow epiphone, that spoon, that spoon, that fret against the mic stand dirty, you stroking a wooden spoon against the rising pleat of your gabardine pants. I love you for that. You inside that growl, that spoon, that spoon, that.
Thank you. Thank you, Jan Beattie. Jan, I noticed something about, you just read Spoonful. You earlier read Sanctify, and I was wondering about, there's a similarity in terms of these are, someone might say these are epistolary poems, you know, the letter poems, you start out dear so-and-so. Is that something that creates a sense of intimacy between you and your subject matter?
I don't know.
That's my thesis question.
Yeah, to me it's sort of like more respect. Mm-hmm. Like, how do I approach, I mean, these are huge artists and, you know, I mean, I have such respect for what they did and how did they do this? How did they, I mean, they're so talented, but how did they get through all the roadblocks and all the discrimination and how did they manage to get on tour? I mean, there was, you know, the Chitlin circuit and all that, but how did they do this? And they did this and they created these amazing songs and they performed and they just sent it out there. And I just, you know, I'm just like in awe of them. And I mean, it's in a way, I mean, you know, I can never do what they did. And And it's almost like it, I wouldn't say a model because I could never do that, but I would say they're like a big inspiration for me, because I feel like, you know, sometimes, you know what this is like. I feel like, oh, I can't write that. I can't say that. I can't do that. And then I'm like, look, all these people before me who had much more to work through, much more against them, have done this. I mean, shut up and start writing. You know, that's what
you do. But you do something in this, in Sanctify, which I find very interesting, because we're talking about Sister Rosetta Thorpe.
Yeah.
But then what's very interesting, because of this, you know, this format of this poem, is their Sister Rosetta. So yeah. What happens, you create a sense of sisterhood that transcends, like, say, race. It's a very interesting, I mean, it's a playoff on her name. And yeah. Then because of how you're structuring the poem, you're saying, you would say, dear Sister Rosetta.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I just lost audio. Can you hear me?
No, I can hear you.
I got it. Right. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm very aware of, I don't want to, of boundaries. You know, I don't want to offend anybody. I mean, you might laugh at that because my poems offend many people, but you know what I'm saying. That's why I'm saying, dear Sister Rosetta, and I never, you know, I have 10 half brothers and sisters who I don't know. Mm-hmm. So for me to call someone sister is a big deal.
Right. Yeah.
And it's a different thing for me as you know, someone who started out in an orphanage. So it's a big deal for me. And I meant it. And I hope that wouldn't be too familiar for anyone, you know?
No, I just think it creates a wonderful sense of intimacy, you know, connection. Yeah. And that's why I want to underscore that. As we come to near the end of our program,
I need more time. I need like an hour.
Well, you know, that's why I miss you so much. You know, but talk about, and this comes out in your memoir, American Bastard. And I wanted you to read Those Night Road, yeah. Wyoming, because geography, your traveling, landscape is very much something that you're influenced by. I remember reading in American Bastard, you going up to Canada and the landscape speaking to you.
Oh, yeah.
Don't go away. This is radio. You know, we're looking at, we're doing it Zoom. So, you know, people can get to see that you're looking for your poem.
Not going away. when I, when, yeah, I traveled across Canada back and forth four times on a train on Via Rail. Two times before I knew I was half Canadian, before I knew my birth father was a Canadian hockey player. So I was just compelled. I mean, I'm still compelled to go.
Okay, west. Let's hear this poem, because we're going to close out with this poem.
Okay, here's the poem. Those night roads, Wyoming. Those night roads that span long in the dark through the foothills, with only the taillights of a far-off car to lead you for light. That wild loneliness and hill freedom. And in the long distance, another road with blue light behind it. Is it the sky haze from a half-gone town against the black dark, cutting the landscape in two, those night roads?
Yeah, Beanie, you know, that is an extremely beautiful poem, you know, and if someone's not, wanted to define you, to me, this poem says, okay, there is this beautiful sweetness and the jam that when I see you, that this is the poem I see. So I just want to say that in closing, Jan, I always enjoy being in your presence, and you're very much an inspiration. And I know you've been very important to the city of Pittsburgh in terms of the literary community. So I know they're very grateful to have you there. I mean, Ed's no longer there, but you're there. And I think it's a blessing for that city.
Thanks, Alfred. Thanks for this interview. It's great to talk with you. And and you're everything to Washington, D.C. They have a day named after you.
That was probably done during a leap year. Anyway, Jan Beattie has been my guest today. We've been listening to her reading from her new collection, Drag Stripping. It's a wonderful book, you know, that you can obtain from the University of Pittsburgh Press. So the show is On the Margin. My name's Ethelbert Miller. This station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
That time again, join WPFW as we move to get fit at the annual 5K run walk for total fitness. Dynamic fitness instructors will be there, free healthy snacks and water, exciting music, boat rides for families, and a double dutch contest and a hand dance contest are all included in the 5K fundraiser. This event takes place at the Bladensburg Waterfront Park, 4601 Annapolis Road in Bladensburg, Maryland, from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Saturday, September 14th. Now, for more details on how to register, visit our website, wpfw.org, or call 202-888-5484. That's 202-888-5484. Meet you at the park on Saturday, September 14th, 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. WPFW, making a better world, one broadcast at a time.
WPFW's This Is Reggae Music and the Reggae Experience presents a fundraising concert featuring Image Band, Curlew Reggae All-Stars Band, Lady Flame, and Carl Malcolm on Saturday, October the 5th, 7 p.m. until midnight at King Solomon Lodge, 2245 Rhode Island Avenue, Northeast Washington, D.C. Tickets available at Eventbrite by searching WPFW. All proceeds benefit WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Attention jazz and creative music fans. On Friday, September 27th, New York meets D.C. when pianist Matthew Shipp's trio performs on a double bill with Washington's own pianist and bandleader Janelle Gill and her trio at the NYU campus in downtown D.C. Matthew Shipp will also stick around after the concert for a question and answer session with the audience, moderated by Bushmeat Sound System, a.k.a. Dr. Thomas Stanley. This concert on Friday, September 27th, is presented by Capital Bop. Tickets and more info can be found at capitalbop.com. That's capitalbop.com. That's capitalbop.com.